The Guardian. A diagnosis of cancer is always going to be a life-changing event, but when the patient is a child, the blow must feel even more acute. However, in a sense, childhood cancer is one of the great success stories of oncology. In the US, more than 80% of childhood cancer patients will now survive in the long term, compared to less than 60% in the mid-1970s. As a result, there is a rapidly growing population of childhood cancer survivors who are living long into adulthood. By looking at these survivors and trying to understand their experiences, could the way childhood cancers are treated and understood be about to change?
I guess, as I have shown, you know, a personal experience is a unique perspective which creates very innovative research. But we can do that by talking to the people who have gone through it too, because they're willing to talk to us, and we as researchers really need to kind of speak to them in a common language that we both understand.
Now that these children are surviving into their adolescence, early adulthood, and even now into late adulthood, we're starting to realize that that cure has come with a price.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Hello.
Hi, Vicky.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are things? To start with, I spoke to a cancer researcher who's been thinking about this issue.
Oh, it was amazing. It was absolutely crazy.
This is Dr. Vicky Forster.
I am a postdoctoral fellow at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto in Canada.
I spoke to Vicky via Skype recently and started by asking her about her own early experience with cancer.
I was diagnosed with childhood leukemia when I was 7 years old. And I was actually treated at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London for 2.5 years, which is a standard amount of time a child is treated for leukemia. And I've been in remission for 23 years now. But it seems a long time ago, but also I do remember a fair bit about the experience.
What kind of treatment regime did you have to undergo? Was it a kind of constant stay in hospital? It's a really long period, especially for a seven-year-old.
Yeah, when I was first diagnosed, I was actually in the hospital in London for 3 months in one stretch. And I think that was the longest stretch I spent constantly in hospital. Me and my family were quite lucky because we actually lived just outside London in Chelmsford in Essex. So we're able to go home more often than maybe some families were. But it was in and out of hospital for about 2.5 years for minor operations. And, you know, some of the chemotherapy agents are pretty toxic, so you have to be in the hospital for monitoring for a lot of them. So I actually only stopped having long-term follow-up checkups a couple of years ago.
And the outlook for children with leukemia has really improved over the last few decades. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I think when I had it, for the type of leukemia and the specific genetics that kind of the DNA mutations that caused my leukemia, I had about a 65% chance of survival. Now, for all childhood leukemias, we're looking at about 90% or maybe even more in developed countries at least. So childhood leukemia is, I guess, almost the shining light for all cancer treatments in terms of progress. So there's a lot of work that has been done, but of course, unfortunately, we still do lose sort of 5 to 10% of children.
Mm-hmm. And has that change been brought about by sort of radical changes to the way children are treated, or what's led to that improvement?
No, it's a strange thing, really, that actually there's not been many new treatments, or any new treatments actually, for the majority of types of childhood leukemia. There's some specific types which maybe one or even two new drugs are used for, but most of the progress that's actually been made is using the same drugs that was sometimes used 30 or even 40 years ago, just using them in kind of different times and different combinations. So it's kind of been optimized over clinical trials over several decades. So it's strange, really. It's not new drugs, it's just using the same drugs in a tried and tested way. And it's, of course, a little bit more about learning the biology of leukemia and what causes relapses, for example. So once we understand them, we can kind of prescribe our drugs in better ways to tackle those specific kind of needs.
And it's this optimization of treatments that means the survival rate for childhood cancers is increasing. The side effects of treatments, though, are still a big concern, especially when lots of different drugs are being given in succession. This is something that Vicky experienced firsthand.
When I was on treatment, I had something called stroke-like syndrome, which we believe is caused by a drug called methotrexate, which is used not only for cancer, but other things like rheumatoid arthritis, albeit in a much smaller dose generally than children with cancer get. But essentially, I'd gone into hospital in London for a normal set of this drug treatment, which I'd actually had before. And I'd come home to my house in Chelmsford the day after. And I remember being quite weak and clumsy in the evening. And I think I was playing a game with my family and I knocked over a glass of water and went to bed. And then the next morning I woke up and I was paralyzed completely down my left-hand side. And of course, you know, my parents were exceptionally upset and confused, and I got rushed into hospital. At that time, people hadn't really seen this side effect much. We know a bit more about it now, but they actually flew my doctors back from a conference in Paris. And I remember sitting in my hospital bed or lying in my hospital bed and all these doctors looking at me really, really confused and obviously very worried. And I think it was a couple of days until the feeling really started to come back down my left-hand side, and I was able to start walking again. But it was a few weeks to months until I regained, I think, all of my strength from that. And my mum obviously has always said to me, you know, that was the worst thing, because we didn't know whether you were going to be paralyzed for the rest of your life and nobody knew what was happening. And she's always, you know, said to me, what's happening with this? Has anyone figured out why it was? And to be perfectly honest, when I was working at Newcastle University a few years ago, I had no idea. I haven't really looked up anything about it since I had it, but I had a spare day at one point at my work, and I started reading some of the literature about it and realized that it still happens to children now, albeit quite rarely. Sort of a couple of percent of kids treated with leukemia get something like this. But I realized when I was looking at the science that it was a lot of kind of medical case reports, this has happened, but nothing as to why it had happened. So I spent a bit of time talking to some clinical doctors and also parents of children who had this similar side effect to me, and came up with a research proposal to actually look at this. And I spent a year actually trying to model this effect using neural cells made from stem cells to see why this had happened kind of on a molecular level.
And what did you find? What was your hypothesis and what did you find in your investigation?
It was almost a bit of a strange one, because we know that the majority of children, all children with leukemia, will get this drug. Only a very small percentage of them get this side effect. So I first started thinking whether it was a genetic kind of variation in children, meaning that some of them react differently to the drug than others. But there's been a little bit of work done on this, and there appeared to be nothing in particular that came out of that work suggesting that was the case. So I then, with some of my clinical colleagues, was discussing, well, what else could be different between each child getting this drug? And we had a look at what happened with the drug in the kind of pathway of its effect. So what does it do and how does it do it? And then we looked at other things which might kind of be involved with that would be variable in children. And one of the things we started looking at was something called vitamin B12. Which, as anyone who's ever, you know, been pregnant knows, is very important, along with folate. And folate is targeted by methotrexate. It stops the cell using folate to produce its DNA. So it limits the amount of folate the cell gets. The cell can't replicate its DNA and the cell dies. But nobody had really linked this with vitamin B12, which is really important in that pathway too. We kind of took a bit of a look at the literature and came up with a hypothesis, which was, if the child is vitamin B12 deficient, that maybe the methotrexate would be more toxic. And this was something which we actually published as a more of a theory. And we spoke to lots of clinicians, both in the UK and abroad as well, saying, you know, we think you should just be aware of this. And as for whether it is truly a thing or not, we're not entirely sure. But the interesting thing was that nitrous oxide, which is a anesthetic which is sometimes used in the UK for these children and not, actually reduces the amount of vitamin B12. And so our warning was more of a clinical one. It said, look, you know, we have reason to believe that methotrexate might be more toxic in children who have lower vitamin B12 levels. And if you anesthetize them with this whilst giving them the methotrexate, we have a reason to believe that that will reduce the levels of vitamin B12 further. So maybe you should use something else. And The paper was reasonably well received, and I think it led to a sort of reduction, at least in the UK, of centres which were using it, not using it anymore. So it was more a, we think this is an unnecessary risk. There are plenty of other anaesthetics you could use. Perhaps you shouldn't do that.
Vicky, I wanted to ask, I mean, it's amazing hearing you talk about this work that you're doing that is, you know, scientifically it's fascinating, but also knowing that it's something that relates to your own life in this way. Do you feel quite detached from it, or is it kind of does it give you a sense of, I don't know, I guess, like empowerment, being able to understand something that happened to you?
Yeah, I think I've always been very adamant that first and foremost, I am a scientist. Yes, I'm a survivor, and I advocate for other cancer survivors, and I'm very happy and proud to be doing that. But at the same time, I am first and foremost a scientist. So it's very nice, I think, to have the inspiration and a different perspective on what I do. And I think it often gives me ideas that are different, obviously based on my own experiences, particularly with this one where my mum had said, you know, you really should figure this out. And also talking to parents and other survivors and figuring out what's important for them. But it is nice also kind of being able to figure out what happened. But I would say personally, it's less for me and more I feel better that maybe it will contribute to other children not having the same thing in the future.
Vicky also believes that involving survivors in scientific research into cancer could help improve things for the next generation of patients.
As I spoke about in my TED talk, survivors are an incredible resource in terms of what has happened to them. And a lot of them do speak very openly about their experiences, what happened to them clinically, also, you know, things like how their mental health is after such an experience. And I think we're almost missing a trick as researchers by not talking to survivors more about what they want, because I'm a fairly unique example of somebody who's had cancer and now is in the position to do research and understand scientific literature. So I sort of bridge the gap, but there's no reason why other researchers and clinicians can't speak to survivors who are already talking about what's happened to them and their experiences on social media, for example. There's no reason why we can't do this in a sort of bigger way. Because I guess, as I have shown, you know, a personal experience is a unique perspective, which creates very innovative research. But we can do that by talking to the people who have gone through it too, because they're willing to talk to us. And we as researchers really need to kind of speak to them in a common language that we both understand and involve them in the process of deciding what we're going to research and how we're going to do it.
Scientists and doctors are also interested in how the early experience of treatment might affect the long-term health of childhood cancer survivors. Something we'll hear more about after this short break.
So what we can definitely say is that based on our data, there are strong associations with the types of treatments that these patients got, meaning that the chemotherapy, radiation, and surgeries that were necessary in order to cure these patients have had lifelong implications on the overall health of these individuals.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from cancer researcher Vicky Forster on her own experience with childhood cancer. With survival rates now above 80%, researchers are turning their attention to how this unique group fares in adulthood.
Hello?
Oh, hello, is that Nikhil?
This is he, hi.
Hi, it's Hannah here at The Guardian.
Hey, Hannah, how are you?
This is Nikhil Bhakta.
So my name is Nikhil Bhakta. I'm a practicing pediatric hematologist-oncologist at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in the Department of Global Pediatric Medicine.
Nikhil is also the lead author on a recent study looking at the longer-term health outcomes for childhood cancer patients. I started by asking why now, more than ever, this is an important thing to look into.
Really, over the last 6 decades or so, we have made incredible progress in curing childhood cancer. In the 1950s and 1960s, less than 10% of children with all types of pediatric cancers were surviving beyond 5 years after their initial diagnosis. But as a result of collaborative clinical trials in multiple countries, as well as between multiple countries internationally, we've actually boosted that now such that, at least in the United States, over 80% of children who develop childhood cancer are now surviving for more than 5 years, and actually more than 10 years. This is an incredibly positive and, a miracle of modern science that we're able to do this. And stands as a real testament to the community of physicians that have been working on this for the last, like I said, half century. But now that these children are surviving into their adolescence, early adulthood, and even now into late adulthood, we're starting to realize that that cure has come with a price. And although the cure always stands as the most important goal for any pediatric oncologist such as myself who is treating that child in front of us, we are starting to realize that the treatments that we give them, the chemotherapies, the surgeries, the radiation, that are critical in order to be able to get them into that 20, 30, and 40 years of life that we expect them to have now, that comes with a price of long-term chronic health conditions. And so that area of research, meaning what happens after the cure and what is that price of the cure, is an area of research that has probably been really blossoming over the last 20 years because it has multiple ramifications. First and foremost, for those children who were cured and are now survivors of childhood cancer, how do we manage them? What are the types of screening that we can do to hopefully either prevent or recognize early the types of chronic health conditions such as heart disease and thyroid disease and a whole bunch of others that potentially these individuals are going to develop? So how can we clinically better deliver care for these patients? The second element is how can we, just like we used earlier cohorts of children and really built our modern therapies off of our experience with them, how do we allow for the people and the survivors that we have today, how do we learn from them today to be able to then treat the children tomorrow? So how can we, learning from these survivors, actually improve the treatments that we're giving such that we don't give any less therapy to get our, excellent cure rates, but don't give any more therapy than those children need in order to be cured. And so really that lays the foundation for survivorship research today.
It was these effects that Nikhil and his colleagues focused on in their recent study in The Lancet. I asked Nikhil what they found.
The basic findings of our study are that survivors at the age of 50 have twice the burden of disease compared to those of the general population. And in addition, they have substantially more severe life-threatening or fatal conditions compared to that of the general population. The list of conditions really runs the gamut of the multiple different types of chronic conditions that you would expect to see in the general population. So things such as heart attacks and things such as having nerve damage, all of these are present in our survivorship population, but at a distinctly higher rate, or meaning that there's more of this disease in survivors compared to what you would expect if you were to look just in the general population.
And when you look at a data set like this, can you tease out whether these vulnerabilities are coming from the having had that experience of illness itself, or is it from the powerful treatments that children are given to cure them?
So we really did look at the medical diagnoses, the non-psychologic, non-neuropsychological psychiatric conditions. So what we can definitely say is that based on our data, there are strong associations with the types of treatments that these patients got, meaning that the chemotherapy, radiation, and surgeries that were necessary in order to cure these patients have had lifelong implications on the overall health of these individuals. It's never going to be possible to equivocally state that if this patient had never gotten cancer, they would not have gotten chronic disease X, Y, or Z. But what we can say is that, and this is not just only on our paper, it's multiple other areas of research from multiple other different populations, we've consistently shown that giving these types of curative interventions does result in an increased risk of long-term chronic health problems.
These results could paint quite a bleak picture, but it's important not to lose sight of the fact that this kind of research is only just becoming possible because it's only now that such large numbers are making it to later life. And as explained by Nikhil, there's already evidence that things are improving.
So there's two things to kind of segregate out here. There's those that are already survivors, especially those from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, who received some of the most intense chemotherapy and some of the most intense radiation that we have given, and that there are those younger survivors. And we actually do now know, and this was just recently published last year in the New England Journal, that younger survivors or survivors treated in the more modern treatment era are doing better than their predecessors. This is exactly the same phenomenon as the overall curing of cancers. We are starting to see the first evidence that we are doing better also with survivors. And the reason is because of research like this, which highlights here are the morbidities that these patients are developing, here are the chronic health problems that they're developing, and here's what we need to focus and improve. And so by really laying out the where the opportunities for improvement are, that's when you can start making the decisions about where you start to actually make improvements. And so all of that kind of feeds into one another. So I'm actually incredibly optimistic about the improvements we've made already. And as we move forward over the next 20 or 30 years, novel therapies that are coming through, such as immunotherapy, we don't know what those late effects are, but we can certainly be hopeful that either they'll be different or the trade-off in terms of the chronic health problems that they may, that these survivors may have will be favorable in terms of there will be less disease burden comparatively.
And it's not only Nikhil who's optimistic about the future. Here's Vicky again.
You know, at the end of the day, personally, I'm 30. I've run 20 half marathons, one marathon, managed to go do my PhD. I now live in Canada. I did a TED talk. You know, I'm not meaning to brag. I'm just saying that the things that I've spoken about do not affect everybody. And I'm not entirely sure what my future holds. But for every survivor who unfortunately does experience something from their treatment, there are also people who, at least several years after treatment, are perfectly healthy.
Special thanks this week to Vicky Forster and Nikhil Bakhter. If you've got any questions, queries or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.